May it please the court, counsel, Michael M. O'Brien, 24138, for the appellant, John Kretschy. We are back here again. I know this division is certainly aware of Kretschy 1 and its decision. As set forth in that opinion, court declared that a gift from a third-party donor that increases the value of a marital asset is presumed to be a gift to the marriage, absent clear and convincing evidence otherwise. On remand, the parties briefed the issue. There was no other evidence presented on the issue regarding the intent of the appellee's mother, because she was deceased. Court determined after briefing, no hearing was held to introduce new evidence that it felt that Ms. Kretschy had proven by clear and convincing evidence that a gift solely to her was intended by her deceased mother. We believe the decision of the court is not supported by the record, and we're asking this court to look at issues of weight of evidence as far as the donor of intent of a third party, because in this case, at the time of the actual gift, parties testified regarding that, and their testimony was contradictory. The only other evidence was a financial advisor of the mother of the appellee, who testified that it was her recollection in 2011 and 2006. Ms. Kretschy, the mother, only mentioned her daughter's name and not the husband's name. So that was the evidence as of the actual date of the gift. 2 months later, wife's mother did a trust document stated that any sums paid on her behalf essentially were advancements upon her inheritance. So we don't believe that the evidence presented as far as actions and intent as of the date of the actual payout of the mortgage did establish by clear and convincing evidence that a gift only to the daughter was intended. Therefore, we're asking the court to look at how much weight do we put on subsequent acts of the donor, particularly when they intend appear to contradict with the actions that occurred at the actual date of the donation.
In the lower court, did you raise the question that the trial court could not consider the trust instrument as indicia of notice of intent because it postdated the gift by approximately 60 days?
To my knowledge, no.
Okay, then how is it properly before us?
I was not trial counsel, so I can't answer that definitively.
All right, let me ask my second question then. Our standard of review for a factual finding is any supporting evidence in the record ends the inquiry. Regardless of what we may say about how thin the financial advisor's testimony was, isn't that some evidence in the record supporting the lower court's decision, particularly given that the lower court commented that the financial advisor's testimony was credible?
I do agree with that.
Okay.
Yes. So, and I'm not here to argue that, I didn't mean to give the impression in briefs that the court should be disallowed from considering evidence of donative intent following the actual mm-hmm. gift. Certainly the cases from other jurisdictions focus on the actions as of the date of the gift, and if it's ambiguous as far as intent at that point, they generally look to the actions of the parties as far as what they did with a piece of property, for instance, who lived in the house, who paid the taxes, who paid for improvements, and those type of things. I haven't been able to find a case, and I'm not saying there is one, where the court did examine the actions of the donative party following the actual gift. But it simply appears that the evidence in this case is backwards, in that as of the date of the gift, I don't believe clear and convincing evidence exists, and the trial court based, it appears, almost wholly its ruling on the fact that this trust document was drafted 2 months later. Now.
Well, the court did, as Judge Webb said, also credit the testimony of the financial advisor. Take the trust document out, and I'm a little confused what your argument is, and I apologize. Isn't that sufficient? Alone, the courts, the financial advisor said, you know, it was only the wife got mentioned here. Isn't that enough to support the court's finding this was intended to be a gift to the wife?
We don't believe under clear convincing evidence standard. No, we don't.
Do you think that it would be for preponderance of the evidence, but it just doesn't rise to the level of clear and convincing?
I do.
Okay.
And are there any appellate opinions in this jurisdiction that differentiate between what is sufficient record support for a lower court decision based on preponderance versus what's sufficient record support under clear and convincing?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. Let me ask you, supposing the mother was still alive and she came into the hearing and testified, when I gave that money, it was exclusively for my daughter, and I thought I made that very clear to everybody. Could the court consider that testimony?
I believe it could. I believe it's admissible. I think the issue then for the trial court is how much weight should it give it? Passage of time, actions of the parties, actions of the mother, and
but that would be
I would again argue, and that I agree that's within the discretion of the trial court. I would simply argue that her testimony contradicts her actions,
sure,
that appear to show a different intent at the time of the actual gift.
But the charter of fact would have to make that decision.
I agree. I agree with that. And the evidence also showed that wife's mother passed away in 2007, shortly after this trust document was drafted, and wife was personal representative of the estate, and she had knowledge of what was in there regarding advancements on her inheritance. And as far as looking at the actions of the parties subsequent, an action she undertook was not doing anything to enforce what may have been a right for her to enforce as far as a quitclaim deed. Not sure she could have filed in probate to assert that right, but that was not done. We simply feel that while I agree the trial court can consider subsequent acts, that a ruling from this court that put it more in line with civil case law, Love v. Olson, Mancuso, Dale, that the intent is to be determined at the time of the gift. We feel the court should adopt that principle, and under that principle, we don't believe it was proven by clear and convincing evidence at the time of the gift. There was clear and convincing evidence, so that's where I was going with the whole thing.
Let me just, for clarification, Sterling, I understand your argument. You look at the time of the gift for intent. Do you disagree that you can have evidence that this trust document was 2 months later? Can the court consider that document as evidence of the intent at the time of the gift? In other words, was the evidence, in your view, inadmissible, or should it have been inadmissible because it was 2 months later? I mean, in other words, there's a distinction here. You could say, here's what she said 2 months later, and that was her intent at that time, 2 months later, or this document comes in for purposes of showing what her intent was 2 months before.
I think it shows contradictory intent to the time of the actual act.
But is it admissible to show evidence at the time of the gift itself?
I don't think it should. I think clear and convincing standards should be applied at the time of the act, and therefore I would say no.
So evidence the next day, the mother says, my intention, I just want to be clear, my intention was to make a gift here to my daughter. That would not be admissible because you said it the next day, even if it goes to the intent on the date in question.
I can't answer your question as far as time frames or distance. No. Okay. But another thing I think we need to consider also is What ability did Mr. Krejci have, if he knew this was going to occur, to reject the gift? Under this scenario, he has none. He has no recourse.
What difference would that have made if he had rejected the gift?
It wouldn't have been made, and the entire home would have remained marital property.
Well, how could he have rejected it if it was a gift to us, to the wife?
What if he's giving up future equity in the home upon a dissolution? If he were to know...
If the gift hadn't been made, then there'd be all that debt there, and you wouldn't have had any more equity anyway, right?
Well, they're divorced 5 years later.
Well,
so,
he would have paid out money, which he would be able to then count for... Well, they would have had to pay out money all that time.
That's correct.
But so here he didn't have to pay out the money.
But he wasn't able to... He would be able to recoup it in the first scenario. He's not able to recoup it in this scenario. He was given no choice in the matter.
Well, there's nothing to recoup because he didn't pay.
I'm not sure I understand why he would not have the opportunity to reject a gift if he knew 2 months later that her mother's going to come in and say, now I'm going to take it back.
Well, let me try to recast Judge Miller's question. The marital residence increased in value, and although I respect that you think that the judge misallocated the division, that was considered a marital asset subject to division between parties, right?
At the time of the dissolution?
Yes.
It was certainly a marital asset until it was determined that it was not.
I think he's talking about the increase in equity.
Yeah, the increase in equity value of the residence during the marriage was treated as a marital asset, as it must be, and divided between the parties, correct?
I can't say that because I don't think there was any increase in value. This is right after the stock market crash.
No, perhaps I misspoke. You're talking about the Merrill Lynch account. I'm talking about the marital residence.
I understand.
Okay. Wasn't there an increase in value that the court treated as marital property and purported to divide between the parties?
Yes, but that also took into account a number of years that they owned the property and they paid on it prior to mother paying off it.
Are you saying that the increase in value of the marital residence was different because of mother's gift? If that's what you're saying, I'm sorry, I just don't understand it.
I'm saying an increase in value is simply a function of market.
Okay.
And if there was, and the trial court set aside the specific amount that mother paid down on the mortgage, okay, and then it determined the value as of the date of the decree.
Okay.
So there was equity built up prior to her payoff, and assumingly there was equity on the back end, simply as a function of the market. I understand what you're saying.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. As the court's aware, other than that, even if the court finds that there was clear and convincing evidence regarding gift to wife, the court on post-trial court initially awarded 50% of what it felt was the equity in the home to both parties. Now in post-trial relief, it corrected the amount to approximately $80,000. Then for no reason, without any findings, it gave wife 75% approximately of it and husband 25%. We don't believe that's supported. So,
Thank you.
Any facts change in the interim that you can conceive of? But when the court went from the 50% to the whatever.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Thank you, I'll reserve.
Good afternoon, may it please the court. My name is Teresa Locke. My registration number is 26148, and I represent the appellee, Emily Krejci. My plan was to address four issues today, the first one being the standard of review because it overarches everything. The next three were the points that are raised in the briefing regarding the marital residence, the equitable distribution of the marital equities or assets, and finally the Merrill Lynch account.
I think we're pretty familiar with the standard of review.
Okay.
Why don't you start with Judge Gabriel's question, which is, tell us everything that changed between the time the judge did a 50-50 division of the equity in the residence and the time the judge recognized that there was a greater equity in the residence, but then divided it roughly 80-20.
So between the original decision and the post-trial decision?
Yeah, Sean, tell us every fact that changed which could explain going from 50-50 to 75-25.
My recollection of the record is that the facts that changed were related to the Merrill Lynch account, the growth of the Merrill Lynch account, the ownership of the Merrill Lynch account. I don't know that there were any facts that changed with respect to the other assets in the case, only those.
And the change in the Merrill Lynch account all inured to the wife's benefit.
That's correct.
So how can we uphold the switch from 50-50 to 75-25 in allocation of the Merrill residence equity if nothing changed that tended to favor the husband and therefore impliedly needed to be offset by giving the wife more money?
Sure. Some of the arguments on reconsideration, which the court didn't rule in my client's favor, but that were made, were related to the race, place, property, and the retirement accounts. And ultimately, the court awarded more of the retirement accounts and the health savings account to Mr. Creechy, to the husband. And if the court looks at what the overall split of the marital assets were, it actually favors Mr. Creechy overall.
But I think my question is, that all happened before the judge went from 50-50 to 75-25.
That is correct.
Okay, well then how can it explain, unless you're saying the judge just looked back at it and changed his mind?
I think the judge just looked back at it and changed his mind. He had the amount that he was giving. He didn't change the amount that he awarded the husband. He decided to give what additional amount was there to the wife, which ultimately balanced out. Why the court did that, it's not clear from the record. However, there are reasons that the court could have done it that we can infer from the record.
Well, there are reasons the court could have done it the first time.
Correct.
And why do those reasons become more persuasive the second time?
I don't know that they do, but the court always has the jurisdiction to change his mind and reconsider things, and did, in fact, before it got appealed to this court. So it was still within the realm of the trial court's discretion to make those divisions, and he did so in an equitable fashion. And in fact, when the numbers are looked at, Mr. Creechy got more of the marital assets, more of the marital property, than Ms. Creechy did when you look at the overall award between all of the financial accounts.
Thank you.
Can we do that on our own, or is that something the trial court needs to explain for us?
I think the trial court does not have to explain
make findings, better said.
Sure. I believe that the trial court doesn't have to make specific findings of why he decided to award Mr. Creechy more money or Ms. Creechy more money. I think it has the ability to do that on an equitable basis and did that. I don't believe that there have to be findings to say why ultimately he gave Mr. Creechy 53% of the assets and Ms. Creechy 47% of the assets.
But don't we need sufficient findings so we can review it? I mean, the problem is we're all left here to speculate. I mean, it is a little odd that the court went from 50-50 to 80-20 or whatever it was with no explanation.
But he didn't go from 50-50 on the overall property division. And I think that's what's being missed in all of this. If we want to parse out these assets, then the court needs to go back and say, okay, let's look at the retirement accounts. He gave Ms. Creechy $104,000. He gave Mr. Creechy $150,000.
Sure, and I would totally understand that argument if something changed in the interim. Oh, wait, you know, she just won the lottery, he won the lottery, he got all this extra money. He doesn't need, I can decrease here. But there's nothing, and that's what we asked you, is to show us the Merrill Lynch account increase in value in this interim. We see nothing else in the record, and that's troubling to me, and how do I know if the court exercised its discretion properly?
Because I think if this court is to second-guess what that court did, then this court has to second-guess all of the property division.
But I don't think we'd be second-guessing if we had some inclination as to why. I think if it was just the court said 50-50 and left it, we wouldn't be having this conversation. But the court then kind of basically cut out a substantial value to the husband with no explanation.
And then the husband asked the court to reconsider that, and the court declined to do so.
The court said no, and then rubber stamped. And we still have no findings as to why. So I guess the question is, why shouldn't we remand and ask the court to give us some more findings as to why you did that?
Because this court can affirm on any basis. whether it was a basis that was recognized below or not. And if the court looks, if this court looks at the total division of assets, which I've laid out in the briefing, this court will see that it was not a 50-50 division in favor of, it was not 50-50 division overall, and it certainly was not a 50 decision in favor of my client getting more of the marital assets. So to send it back to the court another time, the trial court another time, I think would be a waste of judicial resources when this court can affirm on any basis. And if the court looks at it and looks at the numbers and says, overall, it was a favorable decision to Mr. Creechy, then why would we send it back to the court for the court to give us reasons why we decided to make a favorable decision to Mr. Creechy? That would be my explanation.
Counsel, for the, I think you said it was, it ended up 53 for Mr. Creechy and 47 for Mrs. Creechy. What was it before, the one that, in the initial determination, was it 50-50?
No, it was not 50-50, because the court divided the house asset or the equity in the house 50-50, but the other asset, the major asset the parties had, were retirement accounts, and the court gave substantially more to Mr. Creechy than he did to Ms. Creechy. So it was already a lopsided division in Mr. Creechy's favor. All this did was bring it closer to a 50-50 division by giving Ms. Creechy the additional $18,000 from the marital residence. Mr. Creechy already had an additional $23,000 from the retirement accounts.
So Mr. Creechy's share of the marital estate percentage-wise went down?
Correct. Okay. Correct. I want to talk about the evidence related to the mother's intent. We've talked about the financial advisor's testimony and that is evidence of that the court could consider, but the court considered all and the trust document, but the court also considered Ms. Creechy's testimony herself. And I've quoted that in my briefing. The testimony of Ms. Creechy occurred on in the May 10th, 2011 transcript at pages 40 and 41. That is evidence. The court is the finder of fact, the trial court is, in the determination of credibility of witnesses. Ms. Creechy testified that her mother intended this to be a gift to her. So I think that's evidence also that weighs in and should be weighed in this clear and convincing standard. So we have actually three pieces of evidence. One, the financial advisor's testimony. Two, Ms. Creechy's testimony. And three, the trust document that was executed 2 months after the gift. Mr. O'Brien acknowledged that if Ms. Creechy's mother was alive and was able to come in court to testify about what her intent was, that's testimony that would have been admissible and that it would go to the weight of the evidence. And what I would present to the court is that she did testify. She testified in the form of her trust document that was executed 2 months after she made the gift, which was much closer in time to when she made the gift than would have been if she came into court in 2011 and testified. It still goes to the weight to be given to that evidence, and as the court is aware, that is in the province of the trial court to determine what weight to give to specific evidence. Regarding whether or not subsequent acts can be looked at, I think that husband's counsel and I have a disagreement on how you read Mancuso and whether or not the court looked at subsequent acts. I read Mancuso, which is a Colorado case, that the court looked at the subsequent acts after the bank, that had, just in case the court's not aware of the facts, that involved mother opening a bank account and putting her son on the bank account, and the question was whether or not that was a gift to the son by putting the son's name on the bank account. And the son testified that he, the evidence was that the son never used that account as his own. He never made any withdrawals from the account, which is certainly subsequent to the opening of the account and what mother's intent was when she opened the account and put the son's name on it. So I believe that case does allow this court to look at subsequent events to look at, to determine what the intent was at the time of the act of giving the property. With respect to the trust document itself, I think it's pretty clear as to what the mother's intent was. She indicates not just that any gifts that were made to the children were to be advancements, but she specifically outlines that she gave a gift of $214,000 approximately to her daughter 2 months earlier, and that that specific gift was to be treated as an advancement on her inheritance. Throughout the entire trust document, she does not mention John Creechy, the husband, at all. And in fact, when she says, if I have an estate left and there's no one to inherit it, she gives it to the Humane Society, not to John Creechy. So she certainly had nothing about the Mr. Creechy in that document. This, just to, I know the court is aware of the standard, but I think it's important to remember that with respect to the rebuttable presumption, which this court set forth in Creechy 1, that there was a rebuttable presumption, that whether or not the presumption has been overcome or rebutted is a question of fact for the trial court's determination, and if it's supported by any evidence in the record, then it's binding on review. With respect to the issue of the Merrill Lynch account, I know we didn't address that on the opening, but in case the court has any questions on that, the trial court made specific findings of how it found that wife did not intend for the Merrill Lynch account to be a gift to the husband. And the trial court found the wife's testimony to be credible. That is, that she didn't know that the account was being opened in both parties' names, that she was overwhelmed at the time of her inheritance and asked her husband to assist in managing that account, and that as soon as she discovered that his name was on the account, she asked him to remove his name, which he did. And that testimony was found to be credible, and the court based its decision that the wife never intended that there be a gift to the husband of that account. I want to back up, I only have a couple minutes left, I want to back up to one issue with respect to mother's intent on the house. If in fact the only thing that this court was to go on with respect to mother's intent was the fact that she paid off a mortgage that happened to be titled in both parties' names, we have no evidence that she knew it was titled in both parties' names, but that act in and of itself was enough to demonstrate that she intended it to be a gift to the marriage, then there would not need to be a rebuttable presumption. There would just be, that's the law. The law is, if somebody makes a gift to a jointly titled property, then it is a gift to the marriage. But this court created in Creechy 1 the rule that it is rebuttable presumption. That means testimony should have been allowed and was allowed to rebut that presumption, and we can't go by just the fact that she paid off a joint mortgage, especially when we have no evidence in the record whatsoever that she knew that it was a joint mortgage. What we know is that she told the financial accountant or the financial person who was assisting her, what that financial person said was that she was worried about her daughter. Sorry, lose my breath. And that in the trust document that the mother refers only to the daughter. So just the fact that the deed or the mortgage happened to be in both parties' names is not in and of itself sufficient to answer the question. The court needs to and did, the trial court did look at the rest of the evidence and found it to be credible and clear and convincing. So in sum, my client would request that this court affirm the trial court's decisions on the division of the marital property, on the Merrill Lynch account, and on the division of the portion of the marital property related to the home. Thank you.
Nope.
Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. Counsel are excused. We will issue a written opinion in due course.